Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is nanotechnology and what can it do for you now and in the future? As scientists gain a greater understanding of how to fabricate and manipulate materials on a molecular scale, they are also learning new ways to put such abilities to practical use in everything from electronic circuitry to energy generation to sunscreen. So what are the advantages and limitations of current nanotechnology, and where might we go from here? Anissa Ramirez is Associate Professor of Mechanical Engineering at Yale University. She's in town to speak tonight at 7 at the Fort Worth Museum of Science and History. The title of that lecture is Strange Stuff, From Smart Materials to Nanotechnology. Anissa, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me here.
Start, if you will, by telling us what exactly qualifies as nanotechnology.
That's a very good question, because nanotechnology is the study of things that are small, very small. But I'll also add that it's about things that are curious. They act weird. Most people just think it's about small. And by small, I mean, if I were to get your hair and whittle it 100,000 times, one of the thicknesses would be the scale of nano.
Hmm.
So it's incredibly small. It's something that we probably can't visualize or even think about. But if I have that hair, that's not the full story. It has to act differently. So I'll give you an example. Gold, which I have on my finger, you know, it's benign and it's the color gold. However, if I were to make it nanoscale, it changes color. It's actually red. And this is one of the reasons why stained glass has red in it, because it's due to this gold color. So it's the study of things that are small, but also weird. They act differently when they're on the small scale.
So they act differently because they have been reduced and reduced and reduced?
Absolutely. What happens is that the science or the physics of things changes when you change size. I was just showing a demonstration today where if I have a saucer and a cup and I pour water from the cup, water comes out quite easily. But if I have a cup from a dollhouse and try and pour water, the water doesn't come out as easily. It ends up that there's different forces that we're interacting with. When water is interacting with the force of the surface of the water and gravity. And when it's on our scale, gravity wins. But when it's on the small scale, gravity doesn't win so obviously. So by reducing things, the physics changes.
So what kind of microscopy is required to begin working this way? Or are you working with things that literally cannot be seen at all?
They cannot be seen with my eye, but yes, you have to use microscopy to do that. And there's several different ways that you can do that. And that's one of the reasons why nanotechnology has also taken a while to get where it is, because we had to develop the tools to see things. And one tool that we use is called an atomic force microscope. And essentially what that is it's essentially Braille, where you run a very sharp tip over a surface and you register the changes in the height, and that comes out as a picture. But that had to be developed, and that was actually a Nobel Prize back in the 80s. So that's one of the reasons why nanotechnology is where it is, because it took us a while to just get the tools to see things.
So first you have to see them and recognize what their properties are at this nanoscale. And then you have to figure out how we might harness those different properties to serve us.
That's absolutely true. So it's taking us a long time just to figure out what is nano, how to define nano, how do we see these things? And I think that's kind of where the literature is right now. People are just doing a lot of cooking, is how I would define it, where they're just doing different things, and I made this and I made this. I think now we're getting to the engineering part where we're figuring out, okay, what can I do with that? And a lot of those technologies are actually happening here in Texas, where you can use nanotechnology for nanomedicines. It's envisioned that we can use gold as a way to treat cancer tumors because the gold can be targeted directly to the tumor. It can be heated up, and then you kill only the tumor itself, and then it will leave the body. So then you don't have to have invasive surgeries to get to these places. You can just use these nanotechnology nanoparticles to get there.
So how do you make the particles go to the right place?
That's a good question. You have to do things to the particles to make them susceptible to whatever the tumor is generating. So you can put some proteins on the surface. Sometimes you just inject them where the tumor is. That still needs to be developed in terms of delivering these drug delivery techniques. That's still in development. But that's what is envisioned for scientists. That's what scientists are envisioning doing.
So explain also how you, it's one thing to know what these qualities are. How do you manipulate something at the molecular scale if it's so difficult simply to see them? What do you do to change their properties?
That's a good question, too. If we want to put them in a specific region, we go back to that atomic force microscope that I just talked about before, and we borrow from things that we commonly do. So if I want to put paint somewhere, I get a paintbrush and I spread it onto a surface. Well, we can do that with the AFM tip. We can dip it into a solution that has whatever nanoparticle in it, and then we can raster or spread it onto a surface and so that it's specifically in that place that we want it to be. So we're borrowing a lot of technologies, you know, even low technologies, to get atoms to be where we'd like them to be. Another way that we can do this is that we can actually grow these particles in place. So you can template, or which is just another way to say that I can, if I had like an egg crate, the eggs will go directly into where the eggs are supposed to go because there's different holes. Well, we can do that as well on a very small surface where we can make little holes or make little areas where we want nanoparticles to grow, and then we can grow them specifically in those regions. And that's just called a templating process.
Are these things fragile?
I don't know, because the forces at that scale are very small. I mean, you can't touch it with your hand. Mm-hmm. Is it delicate to move a nano rod? It's extremely, we call it a nanoparticle in a nano haystack. It's very hard to move these things. So it takes a lot of patience, a lot of time to do these things.
So there are some things that are being used right this minute, and one of them is solar cells. Is that right?
Solar cells, suntan oils, they all claim to have some nanotechnology. And for solar cells, what they're employing is the fact that we have more surface. And if we have more surface, we're able to collect the energy at a higher efficiency. But I still think that the technology is still very much in its genesis. And the killer apps, the things that I think are going to be significant, are still in the process of being made. Right now, we're just at things that are kind of neat, which is putting nano shells, which is essentially a ball that's empty, and we can put the lotions inside of these nano balls or nanospheres and put them inside of lotions so that they'll penetrate into the skin to a deeper level and so that we can have moisture at a deeper level. That's a fantastic technology, but it's for beauty and cosmetics, and I think there's much, much more that nanotechnology can do. Another example is that we have pants or fabrics that have polymers, or they've also been synthesized so their structure is changed on a nanoscale, so they're stain resistant. And those are also fantastic technologies, but I think it's a bit of an overkill for clothing and for cosmetics when I think there's so much, much more that we can do with these materials, particularly in energy, in medicine, and possibly in space exploration.
How would they work in space exploration?
Well, they're still sorting that out, but so there's quite a bit of debate about how they would be used for space. But the military and space have some ways of how they envision these things will be used.
Can we use these particles to detect disease or the presence of particular things where we might want to study them?
Certainly. Once again, you can have these small particles and you can coat them with something that's sensitive to whatever you're looking for. And because they're so small, it doesn't take very much for you to sense what you're looking for. And so that's great because you can have early detection for diseases or whatever you may be looking for. But that notion of biomedicine or nanomedicine is also in its genesis.
So how will we allow them to communicate back to us whatever it is that they've detected?
That's a good question. We have to not only the particles themselves don't have intelligence, so we have to figure out some other way that we can register when the particle has been coated with whatever we're detecting. And that's another part of the problem that people are also studying. Once you have these nanoparticles coated with something, you have to detect them. That's another part of the problem that I think people are still working on as well.
I have to imagine there are a lot of corporations doing really good science because there are commercial applications for these things. What's the role of, how do you compare the role of private corporate funded science with things that are taking place at universities and at the government?
I think that they're on board because we're all excited about nanotechnology. And so we may have different missions, but as I had mentioned, we're still in the early stages. So the first thing is like we're all holding hands together to kind of figure out what is this thing and what can it do? And then actually many professors and scientists are very entrepreneurial because there's huge impact that one can make. So I don't think they're they're separate so much in terms of their thrust. I think they are like-minded, but, you know, of course, the end results will be different. So in this early stage, I think a lot of people are kind of thinking the same way. You know, everyone wants to solve problems. We want to help humanity. We want people to be healthy. And so I think everyone is on board for that. Now, there may be some scientists that are a little bit more curious about the physics, and that's a separate branch. There's a lot of physicists and a lot of chemists who are interested in the science. There's very interesting science at that very small scale. This year, the Nobel Prize was for winners of who studied graphene, which is just one sheet of graphite. That's nanotechnology. And the reason why they're interested in that is because conduction, the movement of electrons, the movement of current is very fascinating in one dimension in this material. And so eventually, we're studying it more because we want to know what's going on. But eventually, this may be incorporated into electrical circuits and make things much more faster. So there is this faction that's doing more of the science. But I do think a large percentage of people are trying to solve these larger problems as well.
One of the things you're famous for is inventing this universal solder, which people think, oh, solder, that doesn't sound very sexy. But I was reading about it, and it's sort of an amazing substance. Can you talk about what it does?
Yeah, it's a departure from nanotechnology and probably would be considered low tech. But solder is ubiquitous. It's everywhere. So if you're listening to our voices right now, solder is making that happen because that's the glue between the circuits and the circuit board inside of the radio that you're listening to. And I actually thought everything had been done with solder. I was working at Bell Laboratories back in New Jersey, and one of my favorite times there was lunchtime because that's when we would just kind of exchange ideas. Wouldn't it be nice if we had this? Wouldn't it be nice if we had that? And one colleague had mentioned, it would be great if we can bond optical fiber, which is a glass, which we use for telecommunications, if we can bond that directly to a circuit board. Because currently, we couldn't do that. And so I was working with a fantastic team. I had a very creative boss. And we're metallurgists, and people usually dismiss us because everyone thinks everything's been done with metals. But we're like, well, if you had a solder that was reactive to the materials in the glass, then you can do what you just asked. You can bond the glass directly to the circuit board. And so what we did is we got solder, and we added rare earth elements. Rare earth elements, the lanthanide series, are often forgotten. They're the two rows at the very bottom of the periodic table. These materials are very reactive. If I had a small piece of it on my table right now, by the end of the time we're speaking together, it would be a powder because it's just very reactive with oxygen. So we just put a little bit of that stuff, the lanthanides or the rare earths, into solder, and then we tried to bond it to glass. It worked. And so this is what we patented in this universal solder. It doesn't require very much, but you're able to bond to all kinds of glasses. Now, you may ask, why is that important? Well, it ends up that most of the materials in your computer are not metals, they're glasses. And so now we have a way to directly bond to these things without these extra steps where that may fail.
So does that make them faster or does it just make them smaller? So, I mean, I don't know how much smaller our computers can get.
Oh, well, it makes them more reliable. Mm-hmm. So what we did in the past is we just put a small coating of a metal and then onto the optical fiber, and then we would mount that to the circuit board. But that small coating wasn't a chemical bond. It was just kind of a pressure bond, and it could easily break. But now what we're doing is we're bonding directly to that oxide, directly to the optical fiber, so it's not going to fail at that point. So that improves the reliability.
When you realized this worked, did you jump up and down, or what's your response?
Oh, it was fantastic. I remember being in the lab and then running down the hallway to find my boss.
My guest this hour is Anisa Ramirez. She's Associate Professor of Mechanical Engineering at Yale University, in town to lecture tonight at the Fort Worth Museum of Science and History at 7. That lecture is entitled Strange Stuff, From Smart Materials to Nanotechnology. If you'd like to join our conversation and ask a question about anything from smart materials to nanotechnology, we'd love to hear from you now. The telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also submit an email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Anisa Ramirez. She's Associate Professor of Mechanical Engineering at Yale and is in town to lecture tonight at 7 at the Fort Worth Museum of Science and History. The title of that talk is Strange Stuff, From Smart Materials to Nanotechnology. You can find a link to more information on the Think page of KERA.org. If you've got a question, we'd love to hear from you now at 1-800-933-5372 or via email to think@kera.org. Let's go on the phone to Cassius in Fort Worth. Hi, Cassius.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
I'm really looking forward to the lecture this evening. I hope it's as interesting as the conversation has been so far. My question was in specifics to, in 1994, I wrote a paper on nanotechnology as a first year in college English paper. And it was really exciting to write the paper based on some of the expectations they had way back when, the ability to send a self-replicating operation up to the moon to turn moon dust into fuel, or a microwave that could manipulate at the molecular level to change garbage into a family meal for four. And I wanted to know how the changes from way back then have really played out, what those expectations were and what our new expectations might be on nanotechnology. I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
That's a great question. Well, you know, when you start off with a new technology, you get really excited about it and you dream really, really big. So I think those things are on the horizon, but they're not things that we're thinking about right away. We're still thinking about what's real applications that we can do, particularly in medicine. There's a large thrust in using nanotechnology for medicine. But there are people and visionaries that are thinking about larger scale things to do with, as the caller just said. But we're not talking about that as much. We're really trying to simmer on what can we do that's real and will actually impact humanity.
Is the focus in medicine right now, is it ameliorating disease and injury, or is it about improving ultimately functional bodies?
Well, what's very interesting right now is this notion of drug delivery. We don't want to have invasive surgeries to remove tumors. So it's really nice if we can just have an injection. I'm sure most people would rather an injection than to have themselves cut open to a large extent. And then injecting nanoparticles so that they will go to the tumor site and then kill the tumor. So that seems like a realistic goal, and I think that's what a lot of people are shooting for. And it's been shown to work in rats. So the next step is to look and see how it can help us all.
Do their bodies just naturally absorb or eliminate those nanoparticles after they've done their job?
That's right. So the nanoparticles, once they do their job, so one approach is that nanoparticles will heat up if you can selectively heat them with a light. So what you do is you inject the nanoparticles so that they'll go to the tumor. They have a way to get to the tumor because they have protein on the outside that it makes it go directly to the tumor. And then you can shine a light through the body. If you ever shown a light through your hand, you know, you can do the same thing and it won't damage the skin. Mm-hmm. You do it so that it's actually tailored to speak, if you will, to the nanoparticles. The nanoparticles heat up, they heat up the tumor, they kill the tumor, and then all that brokenness goes into the system and is eliminated. So that's a technology that seems to work in animals such as mice, and so they'd like to see how we can incorporate that or eventually get that to a way that it's safe for humans.
What's exciting about that is it sounds as if, I mean, we're right now all picturing maybe a solid tumor somewhere, but if you have these nanoparticles that can find these particular kinds of cells, if there's a rogue cell somewhere getting ready to metastasize, you could get that too.
Yeah, you can get that too eventually. But right now it's more large-scale tumors that that scientists are shooting for.
Back to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Melinda in Addison. Hey, Melinda.
Hi. I actually had a question about the universe with solder. It just absolutely fascinated me as much as the nanotechnology does. My husband works in telecommunications a lot with fiber optics, and I was just wondering, could that universal solder be used to combine anything from Cat5 with fiber optics or fiber optics with, you know, plain old telephone lines? I mean, I'm just kind of curious about that because it just fascinated me.
Those are all good questions. We actually had lots of questions like this, and we actually commercialize this material. So we've had crazy requests from jewelers that will actually set diamonds so that they're actually bonded to their settings, and so you don't have to worry about them falling out, to more technical questions such as optical fiber and bonding to different kinds of substrates. So there's a range of different technologies that this solder has solved. And so because of these kinds of questions, when I was in the laboratory, I had a small amount, and people would ask me, and I would mail these small amounts. But eventually, we got to the point where we commercialized it. And so you can actually get these materials and test them if you like.
Is it expensive?
As solders go, it's got to be a little bit more expensive because we have to do some processing, and putting those rare earth elements is not trivial. That's mm-hmm. where actually the knowledge is. But it's not, it's something that one can easily purchase.
And you can manipulate this solder with electromagnetic fields?
Well, that's another type of solder. So we were just talking about solders, and I didn't expect solder to be so interesting. But what I had, and
this is our awesome audience.
what I had a student work on was this notion of increasing a solder's strength. Solders, actually, the new solders that are out there are lead-free, and they're not as strong as the old leaded solders. So one way that you can strengthen a material is to put particles in it. Yeah, that's a process that slows down the cracks that happen. And I asked the student to put in iron particles because it had been tried before. And the side project of that is that iron is magnetic. So when the solder was molten, we can actually move it with a magnet. Mm-hmm. And so we can move it vertically. And so we have some really great footage of of the solder moving in various directions because of the magnet. So that's what you're speaking of, that we have another type of solder that can be moved remotely with magnetic fields.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We'll go next to McKinney and speak with Joyce. Hi, Joyce.
Hi, I'm calling from McKinney, Texas, and this question is for Anissa. My question is it safe to invest for future nanotechnology, since it's a grateful insight for breakthrough technology like the way computers were in the 80s? I just learned how to start investing finally, so I'd like to see if this is something that is going to produce some income in the next, say, 20 years or so. I'll take your question offline.
Are you up to giving financial advice on the air?
I don't think I'm qualified, but that's a very good question. Well, I will say that, the estimate in 2004 that this is going to be a $4 billion industry. I can't tell you where to target your money. I don't know if it's in the synthesis of the materials or in the equipment. I'm sure the equipments that are used to control these materials is probably a good way to go. I can't say, but I know that it will be a large industry. And so I would just say keep an eye out for it. And I do think it's something worth your attention.
What kind of educational background does a young person need in order to plan a career in nanotechnology?
Well, it's definitely someone who's interested in the sciences. Mm-hmm. You can come at it from many different angles. You can go into chemistry. You can go into physics. I'm a material scientist, engineering. And you can do it at many different skills. You don't necessarily have to be a PhD to do these things. You can do this. We have high school students who are making nanoparticles. So there's a range of ways that people can approach the problem or approach this technology.
We have an email here from Tiana who says, "Strange stuff is the right name, very promising to be truly useful and wondrous. But we have heard a lot about the dangers of nanoparticles getting loose and causing environmental damage because of our ignorance of how they work."
This is an excellent question, and I'm so glad that it came up. I've spoken to philosophers and people who think about these kinds of things, and I do think we do need to be mindful. Whenever we integrate a new technology, we have to think about toxicity. And we all have to think about the impact that it will have on us. Think about the automobile. That was a fantastic invention. But we didn't know that it was going to change everything. It was going to change the environment. It was going to change how we view cities. It was going to change how we interact with each other. I don't think they had that discussion. But we've had the car and we've had other technologies. I think this is a conversation that one should definitely have about nanotechnology. There are people who are considering nanotoxicity. How does it influence us? If we have it in the environment, how do we pull things out of, how do we pull it out of water and things like that? So people are thinking about that. I think more discussion and more thoughts about that. And that's why I'm glad that your viewers are bringing that up. These are the questions that they should be asking when someone proposes these new technologies to them.
Can you talk a little bit about nanotechnology being developed to mimic things that occur naturally in biological organisms?
It's a great question. Mother Nature had a long time to figure these things out, so the best thing to do is to copy her. You know, Picasso said, you know, good artists borrow, great artists steal. And so we're good artists and we're going to borrow from nature. So just like Velcro is actually based on a biological organism that can attach, it's a small plant that has these spurs that attach to your shoe and shoelace. That's what Velcro is based on. And scientists have been doing this for a while of borrowing things from nature into the sciences. So that's occurring in nanotechnology as well. I don't have anything specific that's coming to mind, but we often use what's been done in the past as a way to integrate it again.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Richardson. We have Don on the line. Hey, Don.
Hello.
Hi, Don.
Yes. My question is kind of a two-part question. First of all, you mentioned rare earth elements. And what I would like to know is, are these rare earth elements uniquely essential to the process of nanotechnology? And if so, what country produces them more so than any other? And then would you name a few of these other rare earth elements? I know that beryllium is one. That's the only one I can think of, though. What are some of the others? That's all. That's the end of my question.
Thanks for a call.
That's a great question. So these universal solders, I would say, is separate from nanotechnology. That's just an invention that I had time to make. And when we say rare earth materials, we're talking about the lanthanide series. There are materials like cerium, lutetium, erbium. They're not very common metals in terms of our knowledge about them. They're called rare earths, but they're actually not that rare. They're actually mined. And they're mined mostly in China. China produces about 95% of the rare earths that are out there. And the reason why I'm interested in rare earths are not only for the universal solders, but they're very important to us in the United States because as we move away from oil, we're actually looking to build our new proposal for Energy 2.0, so wind technology electric cars. They actually require rare earth metals because they make up magnets. Magnets are critical for these technologies. Now, the thing about rare earths is that we don't mine them, and the exports of these rare earths are actually going to be reduced significantly from our friend China. And so when I made this universal solder some time ago, rare earths were plentiful, but now they're actually becoming rare. Their name is actually suiting them. And they're actually going to be more and more important for us as we think about other ways to energize the way we live.
If the alchemists working hundreds of years ago had had nanotechnology available to them, would they have had more success in making gold out of base metal?
I'm not really sure. I mean, the alchemists, they were employing nanotechnology. Nanotechnology is new to us, but they've been doing it since the Middle Ages. These stained glass windows, that's all nanotechnology. Cobalt is silver in our scale, but cobalt makes blue in the very small scale. And so if you see blue glass, that's because of cobalt. Gold is gold at our scale, but it's red when it's on the small scale, and so that's why you see red glass. So they may not have known exactly why they were doing these things, but they saw these interesting properties. And now, since we know what's going on, we can now employ them in new ways. So we're just kind of borrowing from our friends in the Renaissance.
Can we use nanotech to generate energy?
That's a good question. We are in the process of not only developing nanoparticles, but nanorods. You can think of cylinders that are made out of these materials that are on a very, very small scale. And I don't know of any research specifically, but you can generate energy by having dissimilar materials next to each other, and you can make a battery. So it doesn't seem too far-fetched that if a scientist were able to make two materials that had alternating materials, A and B, A and B, and we're able to capture the flow of electrons between them so you can easily make a battery. So I don't know that specifically, but I don't think that's too far-fetched.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Shahab in Plano. Hi, Shahab.
Hi. I just have a quick question. Can nanotechnology or the nanoparticles be used for data storage?
That's a great question. You had me stumped there. I'm sure that if we made some kind of magnetic version of that and were able to read it, you can use it for data storage. So I don't think it can store data itself, but you can arrange the particles in a certain way that they can be read, particularly with an AFM and the like, as a way to store data. So I don't think that that's too far-fetched either.
We have a question here via email from Teresa, who wants to know, is nanotechnology able to create a link between the brain and an artificial limb? Will we someday be able to have an artificial body thanks to nanotechnology?
That's a good question. I'm not quite a visionary. I do know that we are in the process, other scientists are in the process of figuring out how do we link artificial limbs to the body. I don't know if nanotechnology needs to be part of that equation. I think you can look at scales that are a little higher up on the micron scale. When I say micron scale, your hair is about 100 microns. I think that technology is probably fine for some of the things that we need to do in terms of linking limbs to the human body.
What are the most significant limitations right now in sort of the part of your brain where you think of ideas for how you might apply nanotechnology and then the practical fabrication of these things and creation of something that would actually bring that to fruition?
The fabrication, first of all, we have to figure out how we can link to the brain and be efficient with it. So there are studies where scientists have looked at neurons and saw how they connect and if they will respond. So scientists will put copper posts to see if they can detect information from the neurons, but we're still at the cellular level. Mm-hmm. We're still very far off. And then how do you scale this up? So that's one neuron. You have many, many more than one neuron. So those things have to be considered. But the first step is to figure out, can we communicate with that? And people are working on that.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. What we'll do here is we will take a call from Bob in Fort Worth. Bob, we'll take your question, and then after we have our break, we'll get Anissa's answer.
Okay.
Go right ahead.
Oh, okay, thanks a lot. My question is more on the theoretical basis. What I understand about nanotechnology is there are particles that are obviously quite smaller than what we previously knew about, and they react different than what science previously knew, and it's changing all of the theories of the way things work, general relativity, electromagnetism, and which whatever the other theories are. My question to you is, where is science at with regards to reconciling those theories? I know that has a lot to do with practical implications, but I'm interested on a theoretical basis.
Thanks so much for your call.
Uh-huh.
We'll get an answer in just a minute. My guest is Anissa Ramirez, Associate Professor of Mechanical Engineering at Yale, in town to deliver a lecture tonight at the Fort Worth Museum of Science and History. It's called Strange Stuff, From Smart Materials to Nanotechnology. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Email address is think@kera.org. We'll be back to more of your questions in a couple of minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Associate Professor of Mechanical Engineering at Yale University, Anissa Ramirez. She's in town to lecture tonight at the Fort Worth Museum of Science and History. The title of that talk, Strange Stuff, From Smart Materials to Nanotechnology. You can find a link to more information about that 7 p.m. appearance on the Think page of KERA.org. In the meantime, we have this question that Bob posed before the break, Anissa, about where science is with regard to reconciling what we know about the world on a cosmic scale with what we're learning about the world on a nanoscale.
It's a good question. He did propose that, gold, which is benign and people use it all the time for cosmetics and ornamentation, is now when it's on the very, very small scale, is reactive. And that being due to its scale, the surface to volume ratio, that's how what a scientist would say, that surface to volume ratio has changed. But this notion of things behaving differently at different scales is something that scientists have been comfortable with for a long, long time. Gravity is something that you and I contend with, but atoms don't contend with it, and that has to do with their mass. So if there's an overarching expression or equation that can solve these different linkages from cosmic all the way to nano, I don't think we're quite there yet, but do we feel comfortable with things being different one way and being different another way? Yeah, we're comfortable with it, and we use what we know at our scale, and then we borrow from that to explore with the nanoscale and see what's available to us.
Have the past couple of decades required scientists from different disciplines to get better at communicating with one another?
Absolutely. And also, it really requires for us to be interdisciplinary. Before, we used to be silos where the chemists would be one way and the physics would be somewhere other, mathematicians would be another way. We can't do that anymore, not in this society. You have to be able to talk about different things and be willing to communicate. That was the first step. Be willing to communicate with people who aren't necessarily in your field. And they may know about the same effect that is troubling you, but they may describe it a different way and may be looking at it from a different approach. So your willingness and openness to explore how they see it. And then all of our information increases if we have these dialogues. So because of things like nanotechnology and information systems and everything, we actually have to be more interdisciplinary and be willing to learn other fields. Biomedicine is related to nano, and so that requires physics, chemistry, medicine, bioengineering. All those people need to talk to each other.
Back to the phones now, 1-800-933-5372. This time, let's speak with Joyce in Arlington. Hey, Joyce.
Good afternoon. It's so good to hear women talk about real stuff. I'm just loving it. I was one of those pioneers in computer programming in the early 70s. My question is that we have a lot of people who are scientists, engineers, lots of patents, all kinds of stuff. They're retiring at 50. Couldn't you use that brain power if they learned a bit more about nano to help you in your experimentation and your investigation? Could we just get those people back and start them to do that? Because I want us to be extremely competitive. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
That's a good question. I guess we'd have to figure out what's motivating them to leave and figure out a way to motivate them to come back in. I think what would motivate a lot of people is if we had some universal question that was proposed. If, you know, Obama said, I want to solve X, and there's a certain prize to that. I think a lot of people would jump back into the pool and be excited and want to work on that. I think that's what the space program did. Unfortunately, that's what wars did. They unified people to work on a unifying question. And we're kind of not in that space right now in terms of nanotechnology. We don't have an overarching question that's energizing everyone. We're doing it for our own curiosity. But if we had some unifying goal, I think a lot of people would jump back and want to be excited and do what we're do something related to that problem.
Is there reason to believe that there might be a nanotech application for something like carbon capture?
Yeah, certainly. Certainly. There's a lot of people who are working on that. That's a big problem. But once again, we don't have this unifying, you know, it could be one scientist is working on it here and another scientist is working on it here and maybe another scientist in another country is working on that. And large groups should work on this, or there should be large national labs that they're just focused on this and maybe even have citizen scientists contribute to it as well. That's what I mean.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Fort Worth next and speak with John. Hey, John.
Hi, it's a great show. I just tuned in a few minutes ago. While I was on hold, I thought of another question. But I work in oil and gas, and we have a tool that's called a rare earth magnet. It's roughly the size of a marshmallow encased in a stainless steel sleeve, but I've played with it in the shop a couple of times and literally picked up things that weighed 90, 95 pounds.
Wow.
So I was just curious what constituted a rare earth magnet, if you knew that. And also, secondary question, just in listening, how influential are things like swarm theory whenever you're engineering and planning out nanotechnology applications? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
That's a good question. So the rare earth magnet, it's given that name by what's made out of its composition. It's probably made of neodymium, iron, and boron. That's a very popular rare earth magnet, and it's very strong. In fact, I would caution you not to put your finger between the magnet and something else because it will pull up something with tremendous force and will hurt your finger. So they're common materials, even though they're called rare earths. And in terms of swarm theory, I don't really know too many people who are working on that. I know that they're thinking about nanorobots and how we can have them kind of communicate and work together, sort of like fish in moving together. I don't know very much about it, but I think people are coming at this problem or this new technology of nanotechnology from all directions. Anything that's interesting to them, they're trying to apply it. I just don't know the specific individual who's thinking about that.
Can you just, for my edification, explain what swarm theory is?
It's when individuals are interacting in a group and then moving together or communicating together or building some together, like ants? How do they communicate with each other and work as a small community? This is how I understand the question.
So they might each have a different function, but they're trying to do the same thing.
That's right. And they work as a unifying community. This is how I'm understanding the question. Mm-hmm. So if you have these nanoparticles, how do you get them to work together? When I was talking about the technologies for nanomedicine, we were just kind of relying on the blood to take them there and to transport and using what the body's already providing. But how do you get them to do it on their own without this kinds of assistance? Someone's working on that, but I just don't know to what extent or how far along that is.
Let's go back to the phones now. Next on the line, we have Lenny in Irving. Hi, Lenny.
Hi there, Chris. Great show as usual.
Thank you.
I have a question for your speaker. I read recently and in an investment letter that there are two companies at least that are actually ready to commercialize a nanoparticle type of device that would actually trap viruses, specifically like hepatitis C, which is very difficult to treat, and actually destroy the virus by entrapping it, and that this may revolutionize vaccination because vaccines rely on building up immunity, whereas these particles don't rely on that at all, and therefore the viruses cannot change once they're trapped, they're gone. Does your speaker know anything about that? I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks.
Thanks for your call.
That's a great question. That's what's so neat about nanotechnology in terms of its medicine. When we're trying to kill a tumor or get a virus, we take medicines, we ingest them through our mouth or we get an injection, and they have to travel all throughout the body to get to the target. But now with nanotechnology, you can either inject it directly where it needs to go, or you can give it some kind of intelligence or some smarts that it knows to go directly where to go and to attack. So I don't know specifically about that technology because there's so many things going on in the nanotechnology world. But it's not far-fetched to think that you can do something to a nanoparticle and have it so that it has some kind of polymer or protein on the surface that it knows what the certain disease is and then can entrap it and then can attack it specifically. And so that you don't have to take medicines that will that can have side effects for the entire body, but it's specifically targeted. And I actually think that's really fascinating about nanotechnology. You can have something that addresses where the problem is, goes right to the problem, the rest of the body doesn't have to experience damage, and then it will leave the body.
So I have to ask you about this, Anissa. We've talked on this show on occasion about the great minds of, say, the Enlightenment, and you have these mostly men at that time, probably some great female minds that nobody paid attention to, but working on meteorology and physics, and they're also working on, you know, democracy and philosophy. These days, they were brilliant, brilliant people, but these days the science has advanced so far. Are we losing something because many scientists are forced by the volume of knowledge they have in one subject not to pay as much attention to the other things that are taking place?
That's a very good question. I'm actually a proponent for people who are Renaissance people. If you know art, if you know these other fields, they only make you better at your other field. I would rather a surgeon who was a seamstress than a surgeon who was just, you know, one of these pre-meds who's just kind of, you know, one-dimensional. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, universities kind of target one kind of audience. They kind of attract one kind of audience. But in my mind, those who have been visionaries and really geniuses have breadth. They can do a range of different things, but they're rare because it's very hard to juggle all these different things because there is so much information now about nanotechnology and all these different fields. Science books used to be very thin, you know, in the Renaissance age. But now, you know, we have science courses where we have very, very thick textbooks. There's so much more to know. But I do think that all of these things, like the arts and math, they all enrich these things. I remember one day that I was in the laboratory and I had to work with something very, very small. But the fact that I do watercolors, it didn't bother me because I had that dexterity. So I think all of these things lend themselves. And that's just on the physical scale. But I think it also helps you on the mental scale. I think all these things help you and will only make you a better scientist if that's what you choose.
What sorts of things do you paint?
I paint badly. I like to paint landscapes. I like to paint the same picture over and over again until I get it right sometimes.
That's the
scientist in me. Often because I'm trying different techniques. Let me try these paints. And I know what I've done in the past. But mostly scenes. I'm from the East Coast, so we have beautiful fall scenes. Mm-hmm. And I'll take some pictures and then eventually we'll try and paint the pictures that I have.
Let's spend a couple of minutes talking about your lecture tonight. When you are going to be speaking to a crowd of several hundred people, and you can't know exactly what they know when they walk into the room, how do you plan out what you're going to discuss?
That's a good question. But what I really try and do is I try to tell them a story. I try and tell them, this is what I was thinking about, and this was important to me, and hopefully they'll emote enough that it's important to them. And I just try and show what I'm excited about. All right, I'm excited about this, and if I can just borrow your attention for about 45 minutes, I'd like to share why this might be exciting to you too. So I try and put things in a story, and I understand where things are complicated because I actually think of myself as a spy myself in terms of science. Like, there's things that I know and there's things that I don't know, and I think I know what kind of questions someone might ask. I really enjoy teaching students. I teach students of all ages. I teach the younger kids as well. And I can kind of sense what their questions are going to be. And I'm also very open. So if I tell people in my lectures, I'm like, okay, if what I'm saying doesn't make any sense, stop me, grunt, just let me know so that I'll stop and try and get you back on board, because I would like to take you through this journey of some things that I've learned. And I think it's really neat, and I'd like to share it with you too.
Do you think younger people are less daunted by how complicated science is? You know, a lot of times you have adults who say, I can't possibly understand that, whereas kids will jump into something and assume that they will understand it by the time you're done.
I think that's true, and I think it's unfortunate. You know, there are a lot of teachers that may have had some science phobia, and what they did is they just kind of passed that on to the next generation. But now information is prevalent, so I think the younger generation can just move based on what they're passionate about, because if they want to know something, they can just go on Wikipedia. So when I make problems or homework sets for students, I really try and get plugged into what they're interested in, because that's going to be the motivating factor. They're not going to do it just because I asked them to do it. Those days are gone. Mm-hmm. But you have to put it in a context that's interesting to them. Hey, I'd like to solve a problem that's significant for someone who's in Africa. We'd like to build a well. What's the physics that I need, or the mechanical engineering, because that's the department I'm in? How would we do this in a way that's beneficial? Students will get excited because they know they're going to help people. Mm-hmm. And that's going to motivate them to do the science. And the science may feel like drudgery, but when they know that it's helping somebody, it feels like a service, and it gets them excited. And I think that's the way that we should think about teaching in the future.
So instead of it feeling just like an exercise for its own sake.
That's right. It's a tool. It's not just practicing the scales. I'm making music, and I may not be very good, but I'm eventually getting that because I'm going to help somebody. And that's what I try and do in my classes. And I also try and teach them the history. So we hear about these famous people and we hear these famous names, and I'm like, all right, let me tell you about so-and-so. He was actually a jerk. Let me tell you why. And I think that makes people feel a little bit more real, and these things feel so distant. But now they feel like, okay, that was a human being, and this is what they thought about. So I think we need to put more of the human element. I understand the textbook publishers need to consolidate because there's a lot to learn. But I think it's up to the job of the teacher to make it human again and inject the stories and why this is interesting and why this is interesting to me, or what happened to me in the lab and why I understand this. I think that's our role, to add spice to these things so that people can connect to it, because the book itself is not going to do it. And we have to work hard as the teacher to make sure that we get students from every angle.
Anissa Ramirez is Associate Professor of Mechanical Engineering at Yale University. She's in town to lecture tonight at 7 at the Fort Worth Museum of Science and History. The title of the talk, Strange Stuff, From Smart Materials to Nanotechnology. Anissa, it's been a great hour. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Niloufer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.